Welcome, everybody, to History Analyzed. I'm your host, Mark Palmer. This is a podcast which examines historical events and issues. The event we're analyzing today is the California Gold Rush. Just about everybody has heard of the California Gold Rush, but most people don't know many details. A lot of football fans have only heard of it because of the San Francisco 49ers. In school, we learned that gold was discovered first at Sutter's Mill. The land was owned by a man named John Sutter. He was a Swiss immigrant whose original name was Johann August Sutter. He came to North America to escape mounting debts in Switzerland. You would not call him a good family man because he left his wife and five kids back in Switzerland. In 1839, Sutter ended up in Alta, California. At that time, it was a province of the country of Mexico. Sutter became a Mexican citizen and acquired a large expanse of land in the Sacramento Valley. It was mostly an agricultural enterprise with cattle, sheep, and crops. The home base was an area called Sutter's Fort. In early 1848, Sutter was having a lumber mill built on his property in an area which is now located in Coloma, California. The man in charge of building the sawmill was named James Marshall. On January 24, 1848, James Marshall saw some shiny objects which were golden in color in a part of the American River. He scooped up the nuggets and showed them to some of the other workers. Supposedly, Marshall said, "I have found it." The state motto of California is Eureka, which is Greek for "I have found it." But was it really gold that Marshall found? Marshall and the other people present knew of two basic ways to test metal objects to determine if they were really gold. The first is that gold is malleable and not brittle. So Marshall hammered the tiny, shiny pieces and they flattened but did not break. So far, so good. The second way to test whether these nuggets were actually gold was to put them in lye. That's an alkaline solution used for washing or cleaning and spelled L-Y-E. A woman named Jenny Wimmer worked for Sutter and was present. Marshall dropped one of the metal nuggets into a large pot of boiling lye, which Mrs. Wimmer was using to make soap. I know nothing about chemistry. However, according to Marshall's later account, the nugget was not affected by the chemicals in the lye, and that's how he knew it was really gold. 4 days later, Marshall rode his horse the approximately 40 miles from the mill to Sutter's Fort to tell John Sutter about the gold. Sutter and Marshall tried to keep the gold discovery quiet, but it was too late. People working at the sawmill already knew about it, and word soon got out. So what was going on in California in January of 1848? The United States was at war with Mexico. The primary cause of that war was President James K. Polk really wanted California to be part of the U.S. Polk offered to buy California from Mexico, but the Mexican government refused. I don't have time to go into all of the details here, but you can listen to my episode about James K. Polk and how he's the most overlooked president, and you'll hear about his shenanigans to create a war with Mexico. When James Marshall discovered gold in California, the Mexican-American War was winding down. In fact, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo was signed on February 2, 1848, ending the war. The main part of that treaty awarded half of Mexico's territory to the United States. That giant parcel of land is usually referenced on maps as the Mexican Cession. Included in this territory was all of what is now the state of California. Think about this timing. Gold was discovered on January 24, 1848, and California officially became United States territory 9 days later. That is a very fortunate turn of events for the U.S. There's a famous quote attributed to German Chancellor Otto von Bismarck. Who knows if he really said it, but it's applicable here. There is a providence that protects idiots, drunkards, children, and the United States of America. Yes, the U.S. was very lucky in its timing regarding the acquisition of California. As a side note, which has nothing to do with today's topic, my favorite quote by Bismarck was when he was asked in 1898, what was the most decisive event in modern history? Supposedly, Bismarck replied, the fact that North Americans speak English. If he said it, he had incredible vision. The fact that Americans spoke English meant that the U.S. would be on the side of Britain in World War I, securing a victory for the Allies against Germany. And in World War II, the common language made the alliance between Britain and the U.S. probably the most successful alliance in the history of the world. Okay, back to the gold rush. Throughout 1848, word was getting out about the discovery of gold in Northern California. For the people already in California, it was not that hard to get to the gold fields. There were not a lot of people in California at the time. But for people in the eastern part of the United States and other countries, there was a question about whether or not it was worth going all the way to California when it might just be a hoax. A lot of people took the position that the Spaniards had been in possession of California since 1769 when they founded the Presidio at San Diego, which, by the way, was the first permanent European settlement on the Pacific coast. The Spaniards were notorious for seeking gold and silver wherever they went. They had famously extracted all of the gold and silver from the Inca Empire beginning in the 1500s. If there was really gold in California, how come the Spaniards hadn't found it? What convinced people that there really was gold in California and what started the incredible migration of people which became known as the 49ers was an announcement from President James K. Polk. On December 5, 1848, in his State of the Union address, President Polk confirmed that there was gold in California. You now had the President of the United States telling the world that it was true about the rumors of gold in California. The rush was on. So how did people from far-off places get to California? People living around the Pacific Rim had a much easier time than people living in most of the United States. People who wanted to get to California from Australia, Chile, or Asia could simply take a boat. It's estimated that 24,000 Chinese came to California during the gold rush between 1849 and 1853. By 1853, it's estimated that in total, 250,000 people had come to California from several countries as well as the eastern United States. So how did people get to California from the eastern U.S.? There were three ways to get to California, and they were all horrible. The first way was by ship. You could take a boat from New York City down through the southern Atlantic all the way around the southern tip of South America called Cape Horn, and then sail all the way up the Pacific coast of South and North America until you reached San Francisco Bay. Ships enter into San Francisco Bay by passing through the Golden Gate. That's the 3 miles long by 1 mile wide strait between San Francisco and Marin County, which connects the Pacific Ocean to San Francisco Bay. Contrary to what people think, it was not named the Golden Gate because of the gold discovered in the hills of California. In 1846, 2 years before gold was discovered, Captain John C. Fremont named the entrance to San Francisco Bay the Golden Gate. Fremont was simply being dramatic and said that it is a golden gate to trade with the Orient. It was only a coincidence that gold was later discovered at Sutter's Mill. Some quick facts about John C. Fremont. He was an American explorer and military officer. His nickname was the Pathfinder. He led the troops which conquered California on behalf of the U.S. against the Mexican forces. He eventually became California's first senator. In 1856, he was the Republican Party's first nominee for president. And the city of Fremont, California, located on the east side of San Francisco Bay, just north of San Jose, is named after him. Let's get back to the sailing route. This was a long voyage of approximately 13,000 nautical miles. Depending upon the weather, it would take roughly 6 months to go from New York all the way to San Francisco. But it wasn't just the time it took to travel this way that made it so unappealing. Sailing around Cape Horn is very dangerous. The waters around Cape Horn are incredibly hazardous because of the hurricane force winds, large waves which sometimes went over the entire ship, strong currents, frigid temperatures, and icebergs. Would you want to be in a wooden sailing ship going through the waters around Cape Horn? Not me. And you have to remember that in those days, if your ship sank, you went with it. Even if there were other ships nearby, nobody was saving you in the 1840s. This was a dangerous, as well as long, route to California. The second way to get to California from the eastern U.S. was to take a boat down to the Isthmus of Panama, cross over the Isthmus, and then take another boat up to San Francisco. This route had its own dangers. Unfortunately for people traveling this way, the Panama Canal would not open until 1914. Since you could not sail through a canal, you had to cross over the Isthmus of Panama by land. How bad could it be? After all, Panama is only around 50 miles wide at its narrowest point, but this was crossing 50 or more miles of extremely rough terrain of mountains, swamps, and dense tropical rainforest. The biggest problem was the local diseases, primarily yellow fever and malaria. Many people got sick and many people died from the tropical diseases. There were also the practical issues of housing you had to deal with. This was an undeveloped area. All of a sudden, people are pouring in on the Caribbean side and there's no place for them to stay as they wait for transportation to get over to the Pacific. It's not like these people were staying in nice hotels. Most of them were staying in tents, and some didn't even have tents. They were just camping in the outdoors in a place where it rained an awful lot. And there were dangerous animals, including jaguars and venomous snakes like coral snakes. To cross the isthmus, people traveled part of the way in canoes in treacherous waters, but mostly they were traveling on foot. There were no actual roads. There were a few footpaths across the isthmus. And just in case the natural hazards of diseases, dangerous animals, and rough terrain didn't kill you, this was essentially a lawless place. There were a lot of bandits who were willing to kill you when they robbed you. The bandits were there because the travelers tended to be wealthier people. It cost between $200 and $500 for the two boat rides from New York to Panama and then Panama to San Francisco, as well as crossing the isthmus. That would be worth somewhere between $7,000 and $17,000 in today's money. So the bandits figured these were people who had money. If you survived the hazardous journey across the Isthmus of Panama and you reached the Pacific coast, maybe there was going to be a ship to take you to San Francisco, or maybe not. On the Pacific side, a lot of boats which reached San Francisco did not return to Panama because the crews of the ships ran off to the gold fields. Even if the captain did not desert his ship, it was often impossible to find any crewmen to sail his ship back to Panama. Who knows how long you would have to wait to get a ship to take you to San Francisco? And you better have money to pay for that voyage, or you are stuck there. If bandits took everything you had, this was not just a minor inconvenience. You couldn't pay for your final boat ride to San Francisco. The third way to get from the eastern U.S. to California was the overland route. There were no railroads. The first transcontinental railroad would not be built until 1869. If you wanted to go overland to California, you were either on horseback, in a wagon, or on foot. The vast majority of people walked. Even if you had a covered wagon, most people walked to spare the strain on the oxen who were pulling the weight of the wagon. A lot of oxen died along the route. If your oxen died, you were in big trouble. So anything that could be done to lighten the load for the oxen was done. So just about everybody walked. Think about walking approximately 2,000 miles through incredibly rough terrain. There were no roads. Anybody who has driven to California from the eastern states knows that you face two incredible natural barriers, mountains and deserts. Today, these mountains and deserts just provide pretty landscape as we cruise along on Interstate 40 or Interstate 80. It's nice being on paved roads with bridges and tunnels. In the 1840s, even if you had the luxury of riding on a wagon, imagine being on that rough terrain with hard wheels and no shock absorbers. These people faced extreme heat as well as severe cold. A perfect example of the hazards faced by the overland route was the tragedy of the Donner Party in 1846. The Donner Party was traveling to California before the discovery of gold, but their tragedy was a cautionary tale to the people who sought golden riches beginning in 1848. You had to time your passage through the Sierra Nevada mountains just right, or you could get stuck in the severe snows. You've probably heard how the Donner Party got caught in the snows of the Sierra Nevadas and eventually turned to cannibalism to survive. It was very difficult, if not impossible, to cross the mountains during the snowy season. Some of those snowdrifts were 20 feet deep. Of course, before you got to the Sierra Nevada mountains, you had to cross the Great Basin. That is an enormous area which covers most of the present state of Nevada, a large portion of Utah, as well as sections of California, Idaho, and Oregon. To get to California overland, people traveled through the Great Basin, which was mostly desert. You better have brought enough food and, more importantly, water. If you've ever driven across Nevada, you know how incredibly barren it is. Imagine walking through that desert. On a good day, you might cover 20 miles. As you are crossing the desert of what is now Nevada, you have high temperatures during the day in the mid-90s, and at night the temperatures are going down to the low 50s. Imagine walking through the blazing sun for approximately 500 miles on foot for about 2 months. I'm not going to spend much time on how the miners retrieved the gold. Early on, there was plenty of gold found in the rivers and streams. The miners used pans to separate the gold from the sand and the water. Later, they had to dig into the earth. Although they originally used picks and shovels, hydraulic mining soon took over. This meant blasting a hillside with pressurized water to get to the gold that was underground. Of course, then they would have to sift the water to obtain the gold from the dirt and rocks that were washed away by the hydraulic mining. When they were using pressurized water, they were not sifting through the water with handheld pans. They were using larger devices which achieved the same results, just on a larger scale. Eventually, companies arrived and extracted the gold on large-scale bases. To me, a much more interesting topic is how did they decide who owned the gold? If gold was discovered someplace in the United States today, people would generally be in agreement that whoever owns that land owns the gold found there. If gold was suddenly found someplace in Montana or New Mexico or wherever, hundreds of thousands of people would not just pour onto that land and presume that they could start mining for gold and keep any that they found. But that's what occurred starting in 1848. There were several factors that led into this. Number one, California did not have a functioning legal system in place. As I outlined earlier, gold was discovered on January 24, 1848, and California officially transferred from Mexican jurisdiction to American sovereignty 9 days later. The Mexican legal system was no longer in control of California, but the U.S. had not yet set up any governing system. People do not think often about what conveys property rights. Say you own a house. You have a front yard, a backyard. You have your own slice of the American dream. But actual ownership only applies because there is a system of government to enforce your property rights. Say somebody shows up in your front yard and starts digging. You want this person to stop. You have two choices. You can either try to physically force them off your property, or you can call the police. If the police determine that you actually own the property, at least as far as the city and state are concerned, then the police would probably force this person to stop digging and maybe even arrest them. But what if there were no police or sheriffs or any other law enforcement to protect your rights? That was pretty much the situation in California in 1848. When Mexican sovereignty ended in February 1848, California was left with no governing legislature, courts, police, or jails. In essence, there was no structure to enforce the law. And what law was there in place anyway? According to the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, the U.S. would respect Mexican land claims. But in reality, many of the land claims from the Mexican citizens were simply ignored by the American authorities. And this included John Sutter, whose vast land holdings were issued by the Mexican authorities. California had a military governor from the occupying American army, but no civilian governor that would normally be appointed to govern a U.S. territory. Of central importance to today's topic, there were no property laws yet in effect. Property rights are governed by state and local laws. Since there were no such laws in existence, how were people going to protect what they considered their property rights? These people were living in a state of nature. There were no laws, and there was nobody to enforce the laws. Something had to be done very quickly. Even when Mexico still governed California, most of it was still public land. But there were large tracts of land that had been awarded to people like John Sutter. So when the miners started searching for gold, the first question was whether or not they were on public land or land that at least was claimed by somebody like John Sutter. In essence, the prospectors treated all land as public land, even if the land was claimed by somebody. The miners devised their own rules. And I say rules instead of laws because these were not approved by elected or appointed officials. These were simply the rules that the miners lived by. On the public lands, a miner could keep all of the gold that he could find. And I'm just using the masculine pronouns here because, as far as we know, all of the miners were men. In fact, the overwhelming majority of people who came to California during the gold rush were males. There were some women who ran boarding houses, which were usually tents, provided meals, and did laundry. There were also a lot of prostitutes who arrived to take the money from all of these young men who had gold in their pockets. But getting back to the mining rights, a prospector could keep all of the gold that he found, but he did not acquire ownership of the actual land. The miner had a claim. He did not own the land. This meant that a certain area of land was only to be excavated by that particular prospector. How big was a claim? There was no set definition. The original claims were as small as 10 feet by 10 feet because they were utilized by a single man hunting for gold with handheld devices like pans and shovels. We have evidence that in some areas claims were larger, 40 feet by 40 feet. From what historians can determine, the size of these claims varied widely. When a man staked his claim, that literally meant that he placed markers around the area that he claimed was his, where he would be searching for gold. You would think that there would be a lot of violence as people fought over their claims, but from what we know, bloodshed was actually sporadic and not the norm. The miners enforced each other's claims because they were all in the same position. Also, the miners were physically at their claims each day to guard their own rights. Eventually, local governments were set up and landowners could record their property rights and even enforce their rights. But for the first couple of years, there was a lot of chaos. Most people who came to the gold fields did not get rich. Very few of them made any money at all. Even the people who found gold had to spend it on food, clothing, and materials at outrageous prices. Some people, like John C. Fremont, got rich from gold because he owned a lot of land where gold was found, and more importantly, his land claims were respected by others. Most of the people who became wealthy were the merchants. People like Levi Strauss, who started a dry goods company in San Francisco in 1853, made out very well. And in case you're wondering, he did not start selling blue jeans for another 20 years. The big money was made by merchants who sold picks, shovels, mining pans, tents, and all of the other items required by the miners. a man named Sam Brannan became California's first millionaire. He had essentially started the gold rush when he took a small amount of gold found at Sutter's Mill in early 1848 and yelled throughout the streets of San Francisco about the discovery of gold. Brannan was the first person to realize that the big money would be in sales of necessary merchandise. He bought up all the tents, picks, shovels, etc. that he could find and resold them to the miners at incredible prices. According to one source, his store was making as much as $5,000 per day at the height of the gold rush. That would be equivalent to approximately $190,000 per day in today's money. Whatever happened to John Sutter? He's considered the father of California. The original gold strike occurred on his land. Sadly, John Sutter ended up a poor man. His land grant, which had been issued to him by the Mexican authorities, was not recognized by the Americans in charge of California. Sutter fought for his rights all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, but in 1858, the Supreme Court denied the validity of his property rights. All of that gold found on his land was extracted by other people. In California, September 9 is a legal holiday known as Admission Day. That's because California became a state on September 9, 1850. This was just 2.5 years after the region had become American territory. That is incredibly fast. To put this into perspective, New Mexico and Arizona were regions acquired by the United States at the same time as California, but did not become states until 1912, which was 62 years after California was admitted to the Union. Fun fact, New Mexico and Arizona were the 47th and 48th states, meaning that they were the last two of the contiguous United States, and they are the youngest states except for Alaska and Hawaii. Let's take a quick look at how new states join the Union. The authority to organize and admit new states is found in the U.S. Constitution, Article 4, Section 3, which reads in its entirety as follows. New states may be admitted by the Congress into this Union, but no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state, nor any state be formed by the junction of two or more states or parts of states without the consent of the legislatures of the states concerned as well as the Congress. The Congress shall have power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States, and nothing in this Constitution shall be so construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or of any particular state. In the early history of the U.S., Congress adopted the Equal Footing Doctrine. After the Revolution, there were the original 13 states, which had been the English colonies before the war. On March 4, 1791, Vermont was admitted as the 14th state. Vermont had all of the same rights in the federal government as the original 13 states, meaning it was on an equal footing as the already existing states. But what was the process for public lands to become a state? The most famous example would be the Northwest Ordinance of 1787. Congress eventually divided that area into five territories of Wisconsin, Michigan, Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio. But a key part of the Northwest Ordinance of 1787 set forth a three-stage method for admitting a new state into the Union. Number one, the region would be organized as a territory with a congressionally appointed governor, secretary, and three judges to rule in this first phase. Number two, people in that territory would elect an assembly and one non-voting delegate to Congress once the territory contained 5,000 free male inhabitants of full age. And number three, a state constitution would be drafted and membership to the Union would be requested in the third phase when the population reached 60,000 people. Those three requirements from the Northwest Ordinance of 1787 did not become law for the admittance of future states, but they were general guidelines that Congress tended to follow. Other than the broad authority and limitations stated in Article 4, Section 3 of the Constitution, which I read earlier, Congress could do whatever it wanted for the admission of states. An easy example of Congress not following the three-step process would be Texas, which immediately became a state when it was annexed by the U.S. The way things usually worked was that Congress would divide up public lands known as unorganized territories into organized territories. Sometimes all of that organized territory became a state, and sometimes only part of that organized territory became a state. Here's another fun fact. On November 2, 1889, North Dakota and South Dakota were admitted to the Union on the same day, becoming the 39th and 40th states. This was because of a fight among the people of the Dakota Territory as to where their capital should be located. Instead of resolving the controversy, Congress decided to just divide up the Dakota Territory into two separate states and admit them at the same time. That is why we have North Dakota and South Dakota today. So how did California become a state? California was never an organized territory. The population skyrocketed so quickly from February 1848, when it officially became part of the U.S., until the fall of 1849, when it applied for statehood. The military governor of California, General Bennett Riley, issued a proclamation in June 1849 calling for a convention to draft a proposed constitution and set a special election to select delegates for that convention. In September and October 1849, a constitutional convention met in Monterey. Why was it held in Monterey? It's because that had been the capital of California under Spanish and Mexican rule. By autumn 1849, California certainly had more than enough people to qualify as a state. When gold was first discovered in January 1848, San Francisco had approximately 1,000 residents. In 1849, San Francisco had 25,000 people. By the way, the city had only recently changed its name. It had been called Yerba Buena. But on January 30, 1847, the alcalde, which was essentially the mayor under the Mexican form of government, issued a proclamation renaming the town San Francisco. Getting back to population, when the U.S. acquired California from Mexico in February 1848, the population of the region is guessed at 157,000 people. The vast majority of that were Native Americans. There were only approximately 7,000 people in all of California who were not Native American. The Native population would decline in subsequent years due to a variety of tragic reasons, including the seizure of their lands, which led to starvation, greater exposure to European diseases brought by the white settlers, as well as out-and-out murder. It is estimated that within 20 years of the U.S. acquiring California, 80% of the Native Americans had died. That is a truly disturbing figure. The first accurate population records came from the 1850 census. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, in 1850, California had a population of 92,597 people. That was well in excess of the minimum number of people required to apply for statehood. As I explained earlier, the minimum number was considered 60,000 people. Of course, the Census Bureau figures of 92,595 people in 1850 did not include Native Americans. Sadly, this is a result of Article 1, Section 2 of the U.S. Constitution, which requires a census to be taken every 10 years for the apportionment of members to the House of Representatives. In determining who qualified as people, that section of the Constitution has the following infamous language. representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union according to their respective numbers, which shall be determined by adding to the whole number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years, and excluding Indians not taxed, 3/5 of all other persons. So they excluded the, quote, Indians not taxed, close quote, as well as 3/5 of all other persons. And in case you are not familiar with that notorious euphemism, they were referring to enslaved African Americans. So when you hear people talk about the 3/5 rule, that's where this comes from. Getting back to California, the state continued to grow rapidly. 10 years later, by 1860, the population was 379,994 people, which was an increase of 310%. In that short period of time, California had surpassed 7 other states in population. One of the big issues for statehood was what were the boundaries of California? Normally, Congress would draw the dimensions for an organized territory and then define the borders for a state upon admission to the Union. But things developed so quickly in California that Congress never had an opportunity to draw any boundaries. When the people of California applied to become a state, they had drawn up their own proposed state borders. The process essentially went like this. The people at the Constitutional Convention held in Monterey in September and October 1849 wanted to be as greedy as possible and make California as large as possible without crossing that line where Congress would say, no way. Prior to that time, Congress had a goal to make states roughly equal in size, at least compared to their neighbors. Obviously, New England states and Rocky Mountain states are drastically different in size, but they are somewhat in line with their neighboring states. The big outlier was Texas. Before Alaska became a state in 1959, Texas was by far the largest state. But Congress did not set the borders for Texas. When Texas became a state in 1845, it had been an independent country for 9 years. Texas was admitted to the Union as an established entity with pre-existing borders. However, as I'll explain later, the western border for Texas was very much in dispute. This issue will come up later regarding the admission of California and the Compromise of 1850. So, how did people from California draw up their own borders when they applied for statehood? The western border was easy. It's the Pacific Ocean. The southern border was also easy. The Californians chose the new border between the United States and Mexico as settled by the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. What about the northern border? They chose the 42nd parallel. Why was that? In the Adams-Onis Treaty of 1819, the U.S. and Spain set the 42nd parallel as the northern boundary of Spanish territory in North America. When Mexico gained its independence in 1821, the U.S. and Mexico agreed to abide by the 42nd parallel as the northern border of Mexico. This meant that when California was applying to be a state, the 42nd parallel was already considered the boundary between California and the Oregon Territory. So, the first three boundaries were fairly easy. What about the fourth perimeter, the eastern border? At the Constitutional Convention in Monterey in the fall of 1849, some people suggested an easy way to define the eastern boundary would be the crest of the Sierra Nevada Mountains. But this was quickly overruled because everybody present wanted to make sure all of the gold fields were within the new state. So they wanted to set the boundary as far east as possible, but not too far to provoke Congress to reject the proposed borders. There was some sentiment among convention delegates to set the eastern boundary somewhere east of Salt Lake City, but more reasonable people believed that the federal government would never allow a state of that size. Also, Mormon settlers around the Great Salt Lake did not want to be part of California. They wanted to establish their own territory. So the delegates at the Monterey Convention decided to set the eastern border as follows. The northeast corner of the state was determined as where the 42nd parallel meets the 120th meridian. This seemed like kind of a natural border because it ran into Lake Tahoe. In the middle of Lake Tahoe, the 120th meridian intersects the 39th parallel. A straight line was drawn from the intersection of the 120th meridian and the 39th parallel southeast until that straight line reached the Colorado River at the 35th parallel. The Colorado River provided the remaining eastern border of California. It seems like the men at the Monterey Convention who drew up the proposed borders for California hit that sweet spot of being as greedy as possible, but not too much. When California was being considered by the U.S. Congress, many members of Congress were against the enormous size of the proposed state. But others in Congress argued that California needed to be accepted as defined by the California delegates because there was a risk of California becoming an independent country. We don't think in these terms today, but Texas had been an independent country for 9 years from 1836 until 1845. That was less than 5 years before California was applying for statehood. These concerns led Congress to eventually accept the proposed borders of California. As I mentioned earlier, the original capital of California was in Monterey. Once California became a state, the capital moved around to San Jose, Vallejo, Benicia, and eventually was permanently situated in Sacramento. Sacramento is an appropriate location because that's where Sutter's Fort was located. Today, in the middle of Sacramento, you can find Sutter's Fort State Historic Park. Keep in mind, Sutter's Fort was John Sutter's headquarters and his home. It was not the place where gold was originally found by John Marshall. The mill was located in what is now Coloma, California, about 40 miles northeast of Sutter's Fort in the modern-day city of Sacramento. The California Constitution was adopted in the fall of 1849. In early 1850, Congress started deliberations as to whether to admit California as the 31st state. California met all the qualifications to become a state, but there was a lot of opposition in Congress. And since this was 1850, the controversy, of course, revolved around slavery. The proposed California Constitution outlawed slavery. Southern senators and representatives did not want to add another free state. At the time, there were 15 free states and 15 slave states. The free states had much larger populations than the slave states, and so northern representatives in the House greatly outnumbered southern representatives. But in the Senate, there were 30 free state senators and 30 slave state senators. So the South could always block laws which they thought were unfair and threatened their way of life. And of course, whenever they talked about their way of life, that meant the practice of owning other human beings. Prior to 1850, states were admitted with an eye to keeping that balance in the Senate. When Missouri applied to become a state, which would allow slavery in 1820, part of the compromise reached in Congress was to allow Maine, which had been a district of Massachusetts, to become its own state to add another free state. After that Missouri compromise, three more slave states were admitted, Arkansas, Florida, and Texas, and three more free states were admitted, Michigan, Iowa, and Wisconsin. But in 1850, there was no proposed slave state to be admitted along with California to keep the balance in the Senate. This led to months of argument in Congress and eventually the Compromise of 1850. The Compromise of 1850 probably would have been vetoed by President Zachary Taylor. Although Taylor was a Southerner who owned slaves, he was in favor of simply admitting California as a free state without all of the other provisions known as the Compromise of 1850. But Taylor suddenly died. On the 4th of July, 1850, Taylor attended Independence Day ceremonies and sat for hours in the sun. During the ceremonies, he ate cherries and drank iced milk and later consumed several glasses of water when he returned to the White House. Taylor died 5 days later on July 9, 1850. There is still a dispute as to what caused his death. Some think that it was gastroenteritis caused by the combination of the cherries and iced milk reacting to something in his system, and some believe that he died from cholera. I know what he did not die from: poison. The reason I bring that up is because in the 1970s and 80s, conspiracy enthusiasts speculated that Taylor had been poisoned on behalf of Southern politicians because Taylor opposed extending slavery into the Western territories. The conspiracy true believers based their theory on no evidence at all. They were convinced that President Taylor was murdered because of how quickly he died after falling ill on the 4th of July, and the fact that Southerners had a motive to kill him. There were two problems with their thinking. Number one, apparently the conspiracy buffs did not consider that in the mid-1800s, people suddenly died on a regular basis, and most of the time, the doctors did not know the actual cause of death. Number two, motive doesn't matter if there's no evidence that a person or group actually committed the supposed crime. And there was no such evidence here. To finally put this conspiracy theory to rest, on June 17, 1991, Zachary Taylor's body was exhumed from his grave in Kentucky. How did this come about? It was because one or more of the conspiracy enthusiasts convinced Zachary Taylor's descendants that he had been murdered by arsenic poisoning, and so they agreed to exhume the body for a medical examination. Even though this was 141 years after he died, pathologists were able to test Taylor's hair, fingernails, and bones for arsenic. Small amounts of arsenic were found, but deemed to be naturally occurring and in levels way too small to be lethal. As the medical examiner put it, the tiny amounts of arsenic found in Taylor's remains were consistent with being a human being on the planet Earth. Kentucky medical examiner George Nichols explained that Zachary Taylor died of one of a myriad of natural causes which could have produced the symptoms of gastroenteritis. In other words, the examination of Zachary Taylor's body in June 1991 confirmed that he was not poisoned. I love when conspiracy theories can be definitively debunked. When Zachary Taylor died, Vice President Millard Fillmore became president. Although he was from New York State, Fillmore wanted to appease both North and South and readily agreed to the Compromise of 1850. So what was contained in that compromise? The compromise was passed as five separate laws within a short time period. Here are the main provisions of the five bills, which are together known as the Compromise of 1850. Number one, California was admitted as the 31st state and as a free state. This meant that there were now 16 free states and 15 slave states. Number two, the remaining land from the Mexican cession was organized into two territories as the Utah Territory and the New Mexico Territory. Slavery was neither allowed nor prohibited in these two new territories. The residents of those territories would decide for themselves the issue of slavery when they applied for statehood. Those territories eventually became the states of New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, Utah, and parts of Colorado and a small section of Wyoming. Number three, the western border of Texas had been in dispute since Texas joined the United States in 1845. The western boundary of Texas was finally determined. In exchange for Texas giving up its claims to most of what is now New Mexico, as well as parts of modern Colorado, Oklahoma, Kansas, and Wyoming, Texas received $10 million from the federal government. This was a good deal for Texas because it was deeply in debt from its days as an independent country. Item number four of the compromise, the slave trade was abolished in Washington, D.C. Sadly, slavery itself continued in the nation's capital. There could just no longer be any actual buying and selling of human beings. Abolitionists had been pushing for an end to slavery in Washington, D.C. for a long time. Slavery anywhere in the United States was a national disgrace, but it was considered demonstrably shameful when foreigners came to Washington and would see the brutalities of American slavery in the capital of a country which considered itself the land of freedom. And number five, a new fugitive slave law was passed. There had been a federal fugitive slave law before that time, but most northern governments simply ignored it. The new fugitive slave law had penalties for officials in free states who did not cooperate with the slave catchers. The entire law was horrendous, but probably the worst part was that a person was required to be arrested merely on the sworn testimony of ownership by a claimant. This meant that if somebody showed up in a free state like Ohio or Connecticut and simply claimed that they owned a particular person, the police or other government officials had to immediately arrest that supposed runaway slave. And it gets worse. Habeas corpus was declared irrelevant. There were no jury trials, and the alleged refugee could not testify on his or her own behalf. So think about this. A black person living in a free state is minding his or her own business, and a slave catcher from one of the southern states shows up and says, "I own that person." By law, the alleged escaped slave cannot even defend himself or herself. This new fugitive slave law was one of the first issues to start galvanizing people of the free states against the slave power from the South. Before 1850, most people in the North did not think much about slavery. Regrettably, they viewed it as kind of a bad thing, but didn't really affect them, and it really wasn't any of their business. The Fugitive Slave Law of 1850 brought the horrors of slavery into the free states. This was the first step of motivating people in the free states against slavery. Over the next 10 years, tensions would only increase and eventually lead to the Civil War when Republican Abraham Lincoln was elected. So now California was a state. Besides raising tensions that would eventually lead to the Civil War, what other effects did California have on the rest of the U.S.? Because of California, there was a big push in Congress to build a transcontinental railroad. This did not get passed until 1862 because Southerners had always opposed it. But during the Civil War, Northern politicians passed a lot of laws that had been blocked by their Southern counterparts. The Transcontinental Railroad was completed on May 10, 1869, when the president of the Central Pacific Railroad, Leland Stanford, drove in the ceremonial Golden Spike at Promontory Summit in Utah. In case you're wondering about that name, yes, he is the man who later founded Stanford University. The Transcontinental Railroad unified the United States from coast to coast. People could now travel to the West Coast or the Western Territories relatively quickly. This sped up the migration of people west of the Mississippi. It also spelled the doom of the Native Americans living on the plains and in the Rocky Mountains. The incredible amounts of gold from California changed the finances of not only the U.S., but the world. First, let's look at how much gold was recovered from the Golden State. $10 million in 1849, $41 million in 1850, $75 million in 1851, and $81 million in 1852. After that, the amount of gold from California declined. Those are large amounts, and you have to remember the difference in the value of a dollar from those days compared to today. That $81 million in gold in 1852 would be worth over $3 billion in today's money. The tremendous amounts of gold reserves held by the federal government as well as banks throughout the U.S. greatly assisted the growth of the U.S. economy. In the 1800s, foreign countries and companies often demanded gold as payment for foreign goods. Because of the California gold rush, there were now sufficient quantities of gold available for such foreign trade. Along with many other factors, the presence of so much gold assisted the incredible growth of the U.S. economy after the Civil War, resulting in the United States surpassing Britain as the largest economy in the world by 1916. Nowadays, California has by far the largest population with 39.24 million people. To put that into perspective, California's population is approximately 31% larger than the next biggest state, which is Texas. To further put this into perspective, California alone has a greater population than all of the following states combined: Utah, Iowa, Nevada, Arkansas, Mississippi, Kansas, New Mexico, Nebraska, Idaho, West Virginia, Hawaii, New Hampshire, Maine, Rhode Island, Montana, Delaware, South Dakota, North Dakota, Alaska, Vermont, and Wyoming. California has almost 2 million more people than those 21 states combined. If California were a separate country, it would have the fifth largest economy in the world. And according to Bloomberg News, California is close to overtaking Germany for the fourth largest economy in the world. That's it for today. Please subscribe to this podcast and please like this and my other episodes. Ratings and likes greatly help with the algorithms that determine the placement of podcasts on particular apps. So if you are listening on a podcast app like Apple Podcasts or Spotify, which allow for ratings, I would really appreciate a 5-star rating. Please tell your friends, relatives, coworkers. Word of mouth is the best way to increase the audience for this podcast. Please check out my website, historyanalyzed.com. Thank you for listening. Catch you next episode.